Really, it's great to be here. Thank you all for coming. So I'm going to take us in a slightly different direction, but one which I hope will connect with the amazing presentations you've heard already. I'm going to be talking about really, really big data and how we link some of that data to better understand which children may be experiencing ACEs, at greatest risk of ACEs. And I'd like to acknowledge one of my collaborators, Pega, who's in the audience. So let's go ahead and get started. So just to step back for one moment, this project resides within the Children's Data Network, which is a new effort in California, where what we are trying to do is link up lots of different data sources. So if you think about children and where we capture data concerning children and their interactions with different public service systems, we have lots of silos. We have educational data here, we have health data here, we have child protection data, mental health data. And without a kind of a means of pulling together all of that information, what it means is that when we develop services and interventions, they tend to be very, very system specific and provider specific, and we forget that many of our most vulnerable children and their families often are interacting with more than one system. So we do talk a lot about the need to coordinate care and coordinate systems. But I would argue that until we've pulled together some of that data that we're already collecting to better understand how much overlap there is, then that will be incredibly challenging to do. So this project is funded by First Five Los Angeles and some other entities within California. And our vision is really quite simple, which is that we believe there's tremendous scientific potential in linked administrative data, and that we can better use that data to inform programs and policies for children. Okay, so we've done, we're actually only in our second year of existence, and so a lot of the work we're doing I would describe as kind of a proof of concept for bringing different public agency partners on board, showing that we can connect administrative records concerning children across systems, and then developing what is hopefully some new knowledge and useful information. So today's presentation will be hot off the press, meaning that I am still just sorting through the findings to emerge in my head, and I look forward to getting feedback on that work. So just by way of background, infants in the United States have the highest rates of both reported and substantiated abuse of neglect. They also have the highest rates of entry to foster care, because we know that, of course, infants are incredibly physically vulnerable. And there is this widespread assumption that maternal substance use or prenatal substance exposure is an important contributor to infant involvement with the child protection system, particularly when we see reports that are coming in within the first 3 days of life or the first week of life. But frankly, we haven't actually had a lot of good data to back up that assertion. And that's for a few different reasons. One is that, again, each system is primarily entering data about children and families that may be required for them to deliver services. So a lot of background details and information may make it into some of the unstructured fields and the case record notes, but they're not necessarily going to end up in the structured fields where researchers can easily go in and say, oh yes, we have 30% of children who are in foster care right now where there was a positive tox screen at birth. It might show up in a note, but it's not going to show up in a place where we can really pull that out. So a lot of the research that has been done that surrounds the relationship between in utero substance exposure and subsequent child protection involvement has either needed to be based on retrospective surveys, often very, very small and localized samples, because it can be hard to collect this data. And a lot of the research, frankly, is really old. It's almost like we paid a ton of attention to the overlap between substance abuse and child protection involvement maybe a decade or so ago, and then we've kind of moved on to other things. So what we've done with this study is to rely on a few different administrative data sources where we have been able to link records to try to generate what I would describe as kind of a population prevalence estimate of how many children who were born in California had some kind of documented substance abuse or substance exposure prenatally, And then we followed those children to see how many of those children subsequently ended up being reported for alleged abuse or neglect during the first year of life. So we had a few different objectives here. We wanted to generate information about the prevalence of medically documented substance abuse, characterize the distribution of that substance exposure across different populations, and then look at the likelihood that that infant was subsequently reported. Okay, so data sources. This project was no easy task because, of course, we were talking about HIPAA-protected data. We were talking about getting lots of different partners on board. But what we were able to do is we started with, and the data feels kind of old because it is kind of old because, frankly, but that by the time we got all of the agreements in place, we were working with slightly older records. The good news is that now that those relationships are in place, we can continue this with more recent data and potentially implement some kind of population surveillance monitoring system through this. But what we did is we looked at all of the 2006 birth records, and to again take you really big, in California we have over 500,000 children who are born in our state every single year. So we are talking about 550,000 children. And we were able to link those birth records to child protection records. We, in both cases, had data use agreements where, as researchers functioning in a university setting, we were able to identify things like parental social security numbers that are on both files, child first name, last name, date of birth. And so we used probabilistic algorithms to connect records and to then develop some estimates of the likelihood that when we saw child A here and who we thought was child A there, the likelihood that it was in fact the same child. We were able to link 92% of children who showed up in our child protection data back to a birth record. The difference there are certainly some records where the information was just not complete enough to be able to identify which birth record it should be attached to. And then, of course, we do also have some children who may have been born outside of California and then moved into California during the first year of life, and where we, of course, would not find a birth record. Separately, we were able to take advantage of records that were being probabilistically linked, that's a mouthful, as part of an ongoing state perinatal health monitoring program. So statewide, through another project, birth records were also being linked, but they were being linked to two other data sources. They were being linked to maternal patient discharge records corresponding to the birth of a child, as well as infant patient discharge records. So when a woman checks into a hospital to give birth, there are actually two patient discharge records that are created, one for the mother and one for the child, and those were also being linked to vital birth record data. And so what that meant is we had two separate linkages that took place, and because both data sets had that kind of common source of birth record information, we were able to then use the unique birth ID to be able to connect those linkages. And on the other side, you can see that around 97% of maternal and infant patient discharge records were successfully linked to a birth record. Our total population reflects roughly 95% of all live births in California in 2006. The 5% represent that we don't have births that occurred in military hospitals, births that occurred at home, so that's roughly about 5% of births that were missing, okay? So then what we did, and this is, in my mind, the incredible power of administrative data, which is that you can develop what I would describe as prospective research questions using retrospective data. So in this case, what we were able to do was look at all 551,000 children who were born in California in 2006. We were able to figure out which of those children had some kind of medically documented substance exposure. And you'll notice, and we'll talk more about this, that I'm very, very careful in my language because I know that there are all sorts of biases in terms of who would get tested and the surveillance of births for substance, et cetera. But what we are able to do is pick out those where clearly something had been documented in the medical records that indicated substance exposure. And then what we were able to do was follow those children where there was documented substance exposure, look at their characteristics, compare them at a population level with children where there was no documented substance exposure, and follow them throughout the first year of life to look at how many of those children were officially reported as alleged victims of abuse or neglect to our state's child protection system, look at how many of those children were subsequently substantiated as victims of abuse or neglect, and finally look at how many of those children were placed in foster care. Okay. So just to tell you a little bit about our variables, so our dependent or outcome variable in this case, we were looking at three different outcomes. We were looking at being reported, being substantiated, or being placed. Our independent variable was drawn from the hospital discharge data, and we were using ICD-9 medical billing codes, where on each of the records there are up to 25 fields where you can indicate different billing codes. And so what we did is we wrote code where we were looping through all of those fields to pull out any of, I will show you in a minute, a handful of codes concerning substance exposure. We then broke it down by substance type, looking at some of the differences in what was documented. And we were also able to look at co-documented maternal mental health conditions, because those also have billing codes attached to them. In terms of demographic and healthcare covariates, what we looked at were things pulled from the birth record. And I always joke that before I started doing a lot of research with vital birth records, I had always thought that, you know, the birth certificate that you bring home for your child was the extent of what they collect, where you see the name and, you know, a few pieces of information. But vital birth records are actually an incredible source of data for researchers. So we were able to look at the maternal age at first ever birth, race, ethnicity, birth payment method, which is of course a crude measure of socioeconomic status, but it's something. When prenatal care was initiated, whether or not a father was named on the birth record and paternity had been established, birth order, infant birth weight. So those were some of the covariates that we looked at. These are the substance abuse codes that we drew upon. So this is a fairly comprehensive list, and I have to say, whenever you're working with administrative data, you quickly discover that there really is no perfect dictionary or guidebook to this. So this was us looking at a lot of other different research that had been done and trying to pull any code that might possibly have been used by a hospital to indicate some type of in utero substance exposure. So you can see that we have, it's broken out by drug dependence versus non-dependent drug abuse, but we've got things like alcohol, hallucinogens, opioids, and so we've looked at those assembled into one as well as broken out. You can see that we also included two codes that are very specific to pregnancy and childbirth, drug dependence and suspected damage to fetus from drugs. And finally, this is the one that may be most familiar to people in the audience, which is drug withdrawal syndrome in a newborn. So we also looked at that both as one of the overall codes and as a code we looked at separately. Okay. So we looked at the distribution of substance exposure by different characteristics, and then we ran a series of generalized linear models where I don't need to bore you with the details of the statistics of those, because frankly this is one of those projects where most of the really interesting information emerges just in the descriptive charts and data. I will say that we, you know, for any researchers in the audience, we definitely looked at all of the interactions, et cetera, and the paper is under review, so you're welcome to dive into the details there. But to get us started, so again, we were looking at 551,000 births in California in 2006. We identified a little under 8,000 infants who had medically documented substance exposure, or about 1.5% of all births. And this is one of the other really powerful things about big administrative data, is that it allows you to drill down with a level of granularity that you might not otherwise be able to do if you were trying to draw on a small sample. So even though 1.45% is in some ways a very rare outcome, it was still 8,000 infants where we were able to look at their characteristics and their trajectories. So one of the first things to emerge was, again, not surprisingly, that infants who had some kind of documented substance exposure looked very different than infants in the population who did not. So here we're looking at a few different variables where the red bar reflects those where there was some kind of documented substance exposure. The green bar represents those where there was no substance exposure. So the first variable there is looking at how many children were covered by California's public health insurance system, or Medi-Cal, which is our Medicaid program. You can see that of those with positive substance exposure, 72% were on public insurance compared to around 48% of those who did not. We also looked at paternity and missing paternity. You can see that for those without substance exposure, it was around 9% of children did not have a father named on the birth record, whereas that was over 40% for those with substance exposure. You can also see differences in low birth weight, the co-documentation of a maternal mental health disorder, and the absence of prenatal care. Okay. We then decided to take a look at race, ethnicity. So we found differences in the prevalence of substance exposure by race, ethnicity. So we found that overall about 4% of African American children in our population had a positive substance documentation. For Hispanic children in California, and I would also, just for those of you who are not from California, California has a Hispanic majority child population, so Hispanic population is about a little over 50% of our children are Hispanic or Latino. You can see that the substance exposure rate there was around 1%, and for white children it was around 2%. But we've got a lot going on in the charts here, and I just want to point out a few things that were very interesting in terms of keeping in mind the potential bias that may surround who gets screened and then what is documented. Among those where clearly something was screened and something was documented, looking at the differences in the types of substances that were documented by race, ethnicity, I still think is very informative. So what you're seeing here is on the lower x-axis, we have some of the different substance types. So we see alcohol, amphetamine, which would be meth, marijuana or cannabis, cocaine. Neo-drug represents those two codes for some kind of pregnancy-related substance exposure. We also have the neonatal withdrawal syndrome, and then opioid. And on this first chart, what you're seeing is just the overlay of Black, white, and Hispanic children. And of those who had substance abuse documented, what the type of substance was. Then what we're doing is we're highlighting the white, the black, and the Hispanic. And to help orient you a little bit, let's first just look at methamphetamine, where what you're seeing here at the top is, this is amphetamine, and the X would be Hispanic. Next in line is white, and at the very bottom is black. So what we're seeing, here's white, here's black, and here's Hispanic, is that for white and Hispanic mothers, the most common substance type that we saw documented was amphetamine. Whereas for African American mothers, amphetamine was very, very low. If we then move over to cocaine, what we see is that a very different pattern emerges. So cocaine was very low for white and Hispanic mothers, but that was the second most common drug we observed for African American mothers. Across the board, we saw that marijuana and cannabis use was fairly high across all groups, but it was the most common drug that was getting screened and documented for African American mothers, whereas for white and Hispanic mothers, it was actually amphetamine. Okay, moving on to looking at the relationship between any type of substance exposure and a report to CPS, or a report to Child Protective Services. Again, doesn't mean it was substantiated, doesn't mean the child was placed in foster care, but it means that someone picked up the hotline and called. What we see on the left-hand side, those children where there was no substance exposure, we see around 5% of all infants in any given birth cohort are reported during the first year of life, and then we see a much smaller share, 1.6% substantiated, less than 1% end up in foster care. Here are the numbers for those children where there was a substance abuse diagnosis. So we're seeing 61% reported, 45% substantiated, and a little under a third ending up in foster care. To kind of flip the data slightly, if we look at children who get reported to CPS during the first year of life, What we see is that about 17% of them, if we went back to the birth record, we would find some kind of documented substance exposure. So that's kind of a different way of thinking about these data. This is a little bit hard to see, so I apologize, but I will again just try to focus you on the important thing. One of the other pieces of this is we wanted to look at, are there different patterns in what gets reported right away, maybe during the first 7 days of life, and what, where maybe the hospital doesn't think it's a big deal, so they don't report it. And that may be an important piece that I forgot to mention, which is that in many states there are mandatory reporting laws if there's any kind of documented substance exposure. In California, that is not a law. A hospital needs to have in place some kind of process for assessing the health and safety of an infant, but they do not automatically have to report this to Child Protection, which means that, of course, you're going to end up with a whole lot more discretion based on perhaps the characteristics of the mother, as well as the type of substance and what the perceived concerns may be in terms of health. So what you can see here is we're looking at these same substances, and we're looking at the first bar would be the percentage of those children with that substance type who were reported during the first week of life, which presumably means almost by definition it's a report coming from the hospital, versus before the conclusion of the neonatal period, so during 8 to 30 days. And then from 31 days to 365 days. So what you see is that across the board with all substance types, the majority of the reporting action appears to be during the first week in life. But we do see that, for example, alcohol and cannabis have much lower reporting rates. Those children are much less likely to be reported than children where we see amphetamine or cocaine. What we can then look at is, well, how many kids get picked up later on during that year where arguably maybe there was a missed opportunity for some type of early intervention or something to be done. And interestingly enough, it's actually the alcohol group where it's almost 10%. So alcohol we tend to really not report very early. But we do see that 10% of those babies do end up getting involved with the system later on during the first year of life. The numbers are lower for other drugs. Okay. This is another way that we decided to take a look at the data, where we were again interested in, if you just look at that top dot, what we're seeing is the cumulative percentage of kids with an alcohol documented who were reported during the first year of life, those with amphetamine reported, et cetera. So you can see if you just scan the first dots, you're seeing, yes, definitely some differences in what gets reported in terms of substances. But then the other piece you can look at is you can look at what percentage ended up being substantiated or placed in foster care, and that's where you also see some differences. So for example, if we look at cannabis, what we see is that in about 50% of cases, a report is still being made, but we see actually a relatively small number of kids who are entering foster care. It's only about 18%, whereas for a drug like cocaine, we're seeing much closer rates of reporting, substantiating, and placement in foster care. Okay. So I am just going to kind of conclude with just a few findings. One is that clearly substance type, we're finding significant variations based on the demographic of clients as well as the likelihood that a particular substance type leads to a report to CPS, which ties to the potential for this wide discretion in reporting. One of the things that I did note is that even for mothers where there was substance exposure, 86% of those mothers had at least one prenatal care visit. So I think it really, again, speaks to that as a point of service delivery, which I know I'm not the first person to talk about. And clearly, I think that these data, notwithstanding the limitations we have, do provide a rich, very cost-effective source of population level data, where notwithstanding some of the noise in what gets documented, being able to come up with some core definitions, some core codes that are being tracked, and looking at that over time is potentially very useful. Okay, and that's me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, our distinguished speakers. We have about 10 minutes for questions, comments to the speakers here. Yes?
I have a question for the you just presented.
what extent, like how was dependence or use defined for alcohol and marijuana when, you know, there's a difference there in terms of like legality, either medically or just for anyone over 21. And then in addition to that, how do you think that influenced reporting when there's sort of a, if there's a lower perception of harm among some doctors that a little bit of alcohol use, or even now with marijuana becoming legalized, et cetera, like the lower perception of harm with that, with the reporting different, and what extent do you think that had an impact?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and unfortunately I don't have a good answer for you, because I have to say we scoured the literature. We've really been trying to figure out so what is the incentive to kind of document some of this in a medical billing record? What is the hospital getting reimbursed for? We also were not able to kind of get any clarity as to whether these codes would require that there was some kind of positive tox screen, or whether it could simply be that the mother self-reported having earlier, you know, used alcohol during the pregnancy, in which case the doctor might document it. So I don't have a very good answer for you, and that's why we're continuing to kind of mine and dive into the data. And if others in the room know anything more about some of these codes, then by all means, I'm interested to know.